This is WFG Insights, your download on the real estate market, featuring industry experts, thought leadership, and what's trending, keeping you informed and ahead of the market. In this episode, WFG founder and executive chairman Patrick Stone tackles inflation, rising interest rates, and the impact on the red-hot housing market. Plus, an updated forecast for the year ahead.
Pat, thanks for joining us. You know, it's been an interesting ride here to start the year with Omicron. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but I want to level set this for everyone who is joining us on the podcast or on the video. It is Monday, February 7th, and I say that because, as you know, a lot can happen here in a very short time. Case in point, last week, it was really interesting. The ADP jobs report, we got a loss of 300,000 jobs. We had Goldman predicting a loss of 250,000 jobs for January, and then the actual headline number came in at 467,000 jobs created. They also revised the November and December numbers way up. I think I know the answer here, but I want to ask you, what is going on with these forecasts and these numbers right now?
This is an impossible environment in which to accurately forecast almost anything. And the reality is there's a lot of factors influencing people, their willingness to look for work, their willingness to re-engage in work. Obviously, the surge in the Omicron variant had some impact. The biggest issue, of course, is caregiving. And the caregiving really affects women ages 20 to 54, and it really impacts their participation in the labor market. As the Omicron variant tails off, these people will re-engage if care is available for their kids. So the ability to predict this with any accuracy or even reasonable accuracy is gone right now. And most of the economic numbers and processes that you hear and read about are based on a little bit more stable, consistent economic background than we're in right now.
You know, that job number is obviously a healthy number, and it was good to see. But, you know, on the flip side, we're dealing with inflation and rising rates. So I like to say it's easy to be the Joe Sixpack or the Monday morning quarterback here, but I kind of feel like the Fed might be behind on this in terms of raising rates. What do you think?
Well, you know, if you really step back and look at it objectively without any political overtones, I think the Fed was acted very appropriately in trying to encourage stimulus and try to get the economy going when the pandemic happened. What they or no one else could actually predict is how long the pandemic would occur, how many variants would occur, and what the mortality rate would be. So the prolonged pandemic has actually caused more inflation than we anticipated. But also, if you look at the amount of money spent on goods, if you go back to pre-pandemic levels, the amount of money is being spent on goods doubled versus the amount of money being spent on services, which was running about 10% below where it was at the start of the pandemic until recently. Now, in the last 3 or 4 months, we've seen goods, the amount of money spent on goods drop dramatically, and services are starting to re-engage. So we had a tremendous disproportionate amount of money chasing goods. Consequently, that amplified shipping issues, supply chain issues. That really put a premium on, you know, desirable things like appliances, used cars, these sort of things. So the inflation numbers were hard to predict, and they were also, I think they're also a little bit hard to digest in terms of where they will go from here. This is not a typical economic situation. This is not a typical inflationary situation. I think the Fed did the right thing initially. Maybe they were a little slow in reacting to the inflation, but I wouldn't criticize them too roundly on it.
So I guess the game plan could be a playing a little catch up. You know, you've got Jamie Dimon, JP Morgan CEO. You follow Goldman, so do I. Many others predicting now 7 hikes this year. I think prior we were last fall thinking 3 or 4. Now we're 7 in some cases. And some are calling for a half point hike at one of these meetings. Do you see that happening? What's your forecast?
No, I'm still at 4. The reason for that is we're already seeing a decline in some of the inflationary pressure. Again, the money has the tremendous overspending on goods. And all you had to do is look at the FedEx truck in your driveway every half hour. The overspending in goods has abated fairly significantly already. I think we'll start seeing inflation drop by March, and we'll see how many times we have to raise. I'm hoping only four. We do not want to do a half point raise. I mean, this is not at all analogous to what we saw with the great inflationary pressure that occurred late 60s to early 80s. This is not like that whatsoever.
That's good to hear. You know, the situation is interesting, to say the least. You had talked about, I think, when we were talking about the term transitory last summer, when we're on the golf course or we're having these conversations, you know, redefining that. And they certainly moved away from that last fall, and rightly so. Mm-hmm. We're still looking at a longer time horizon here. This isn't, you know, you said March we'll start to see it abate, but it's not going to happen overnight, right? So, you know, we always hear that saying, this time is different. We've well established here that you don't think we're going to see the runaway inflation of the 70s, even though it's not the 70s. But is this time different? I mean, is there something we're missing here that, you know, that black swan or that, you know, oil prices or something that's going to sneak up on us here and, you know, make this worse?
Well, let me explain why it's different. And the one key difference is that the inflationary pressure we saw from the late 60s to the early 80s there was no economic or very minimal economic growth. So the way that companies could increase earnings, the way that people could give raises was by raising prices. There was no other way to do it. Economic growth now still exceeds the inflationary pressure it has up until the last month or so. So we do not have the same environment where we have to raise prices in order just to exist. And that's where we were, back in the late 60s to early 80s. This time we are seeing the pressure caused by spending a lot of money on goods and the dysfunction within the supply chain, in part because of the pandemic, in part because of tremendous demand that occurred. So this is a different situation. Now, if it goes on long enough, you will see people raise prices because they can and because they see prices raising. And we're starting to see a little bit of that. So I think the Fed raising rates is necessary to quell that. But I don't think that we are in the same environment where we're going to have to ratchet it way up to stop the pressure.
That's good to hear. You know, when we talked last summer about, you know, re-engaging you in this conversation monthly, it was because we wanted to get solid information out, right? Cut through a lot of what we see in the headlines, right? And over the weekend, I watched two videos that literally scared the hell out of me. Watching them, you know, that there are multiple bubbles, there are super bubbles out there. These bubbles are going to burst. The stock market's going to drop 50 to 70%. We're going to see housing prices drop. And I mean, you know, people who see that and don't talk to you, you know, might pack it in, right? I mean, it's, you're seeing, you know, multiple bubbles, whether it's used cars or, you know, SPACs, what we've seen there. Some people throw real estate into it. Talk about that. I mean, do we have multiple bubbles? Are we going to see a bubble burst, equity markets or otherwise? What's your feeling and your take on that?
Well, yes, we have multiple bubbles. We've had a tremendous amount of capital. We were very flush with capital even prior to the pandemic. But the pandemic has allowed corporations to raise money cheaply, accessing the bond market. And a lot of them did it with investment grade bonds. So companies were able to stock up. Obviously, the average consumer was able to pocket some dollars because of stimulus. So average savings went up. There were a lot of things that resulted in a lot more money to spend. Now, some of it has been spent in what I would say is speculative nature, SPACs, obviously. A lot of the Russell 2000 now is having a problem because technology got just absolutely insane valuations. Priced earnings multiples were just not off the chart. They were they're out of the universe. And so you're seeing some bubbles there. I don't see any bubbles in home prices yet because I see it being demand driven, but we're probably getting close to the upper edge there. I think that just basically that's affordability that will curtail it getting out of hand. So, and I don't see a lot of loose lending practices or bad credit risk practices like we had before the Great Recession. We're not doing subprime mortgages right now for 20% of all originations like we were back then. It was crazy, but we don't have that environment. So do we have bubbles? Yes. Are we going to see bubbles burst? Yes. We are going to see some publicly traded technology companies that have never made a profit, never will. It got a little bit crazy with the amount of money being thrown into tech. And you know, actually the pandemic caused some of that, because it's made us very conscious of the ability of technology to mitigate the circumstances created by the pandemic. You can work from home, you can buy from home, you can do a lot of things online now, and that's going to get more and more efficient. So some of the tech investments will work, a lot won't. But that's where the bubble is probably.
You know, the contrary play here is, with rates rising gradually, and hopefully that's what happens here, is that this is an orderly transition out of what's been a pretty crazy couple of years, right, into hopefully a normal market, right? If income's good, you know, people have jobs, as we've always said, though, they're in a position to buy a home, right? So even if rates gradually went from 3 or 4 up to 5, 6, 7, right, as long as people have employment and it happens gradually, we're okay, right?
I think so. You know, I don't see rates going up. I mean, I think they may hit 4 later this year, and maybe you hit 5 in a couple of years. I don't see them unless something dramatic happens, unless there's some real problem or we have another variant with a high mortality rate. I don't see that happening.
You know, one thing I'm curious about too, living in the Boise area, obviously one of the hottest markets in the country, depending on the day. A lot of people here from California, obviously, have migrated here. And there's a fair amount of folks who bought homes here, retirees from California who still own a home in Northern California, Southern California, wherever it may be, with plans to move here at some point. And they bought, you know, within the past year and a half, have watched the home price values increase here, which was a good thing for them. Those homes are sitting vacant a lot of the time. Do you have any data on second home purchases the last couple of years? I know a lot of people who had the wealth to do so did it, bought. You know, if you lived in Portland, you bought a home in Bend, or Seattle, you bought a home in wherever it may be, right? That kind of stuff happened. But in that middle class category, or that retiree category, long-winded question here, is there a way to track how many second homes have been purchased, or do they come right out and, you know, categorize that?
You know, there are various things you can look at. You know, typically it's called vacation homes. And I know some cases it's second homes, but, you know, typically you refer to it as vacation homes. And obviously that accelerated rapidly in 20 and 21. Just give you some idea, vacation homes are up about 16.4% of all sales in 20 and 17% in 2021. If you look at some sources, they track it up and down. It's surge, decline. A little bit of it is seasonal, and a little bit of it is that you had a tremendous amount of wealthy people exercise the ability to buy a home early on in the pandemic. I think that is slowing down now. You get into more middle-class purchases, or where the market becomes more normal in terms of the distribution of the type of purchases, the bottom vacation homes being bought will slow down dramatically. That was really a function of the wealth effect, I think, more than anything else.
You know, there's so many experts out there, right? And when you see them on a Bloomberg or a CNBC, right, it lends credibility to them and what they say. And I'm not going to name names, but I saw one of these experts over the weekend who specifically singled out the housing market and talked about all of the inventory that's coming online, that there's a lot of inventory coming online. I see. Yeah. If you're on the podcast and you can't see Patrick Stone, he's laughing. And so was I, you know, in our conversations, knowing better. But most people don't. And, you know, the majority of the audience watching that interview is thinking, oh, well, wow, there's a lot of housing inventory coming on this year, single family homes, multifamily. There's going to be a flood, was the quote, of inventory coming on. And you see that, and just, I mean, that misinformation is just, it's tough to watch, right? I mean, I don't know how you do it, but it, you know, for our audience, I mean, you got to have some stable datum, right?
It's virtually in every aspect of the economy, and maybe in every aspect of our life, to be honest with you. I mean, the media is about capturing your attention and selling things. It's not about giving you information. Sorry, a little cynicism there. I really do think that we underbuilt new homes about 1.6 million from 2010 to 2020. So we are short about 1.6 million homes. It's going to take 3 to 5 years to get back to a normal market where you have starter homes, move-up homes, and high-end homes. We do not have that right now. So we are really short on starter homes and move-up homes. So you're seeing builders ramp up. All the builders are pretty, even when they're concerned, they're still pretty optimistic about the builder market. You'll see a lot of homes built, but we are currently significantly short of the necessary inventory for the size of population we have in this country and people's desire to own a home. So I don't know where that guy was coming from, but he is grossly misinformed.
Yeah, well, you know, and I just ask a lot of the questions that a lot of people might be afraid to ask because they think they might be stupid questions, but you got to ask them because that stuff gets out there. Realtors see it, mortgage people see it, and, you know, it tends to concern people and also yeah. consumers as well, right? Who see that?
You know, one of the things that's really easy to look at to decide whether or not you have too many homes is how long homes stay on the market before they're bought. What are we at, about 19 or 20 days right now?
Yeah,
yeah, we got too many homes. Yeah,
yeah. I always ask you this, you know, never hurts about the blind spot, right? We've got an issue in the Ukraine. Right. You've got that thing going on. There's some stuff firing up in the Middle East. Oil prices are up. A lot of money out there. A lot of craziness. That's nothing new, I guess. But, you know, what's the black swan out there? What's nobody paying attention to as of this month that concerns you that could really mess things up for the housing market and the economy?
Well, my concern is a little bit longer term perspective, and it has mostly to do with the emerging markets. You get most of our news, most of our statistical information around the economy, most of the concern about geopolitical events are all in established or largely visible markets. The reality is that the global economy has become dependent on emerging markets, especially for materials, for manufacturing, in some cases for some manufacturing, but really it is the raw materials and things like this. And if the emerging markets continue to have pandemic issues, if they do not get vaccines, if they do not have any recovery, that's going to prolong the problem, prolong the inflation, and prolong the issues. So I don't think the media is paying appropriate enough attention to the global humanity on a global basis and what we're doing about the pandemic on a global basis, because it will become problematic if these people cannot ship raw materials or participate in manufacturing. And that's getting no press whatsoever.
Now, you had mentioned earlier, too, you know, we assume with the pandemic that these variants continue to degrade and become, you know, standard flu-like, but you kind of tossed out in there, hey, if we get something that's fatal. I mean, is that a big concern? I mean, I guess we don't hear a lot about that, but.
Well, that's, historically, what has happened is that the human race has had multiple pandemics, obviously. The last one of note, for which there is tremendous statistical information, none of which our politicians or media bother to report, is the 1918 Spanish flu. It was the second variant of the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic that actually had the highest mortality rate, very analogous to what we experienced with the Delta variant. Then every subsequent variant had been less and less fatal, and hopefully that's what we're seeing with Omicron, and we'll continue to seeing as the virus evolves to a less fatal state. And this is just simply, I guess it's evolution in a way, right? And you know, virus will last longer and continue to mutate if it's not fatal. So the fatal aspects of the virus basically extinguish themselves by killing the host. So long-winded answer, but I think you will see the subsequent variants be less and less fatal. The flu, I mean, we still have variants every year with the flu. I mean, my sister's a doctor, and she tells me over and over again, you got a 50-50 chance of the flu shot being effective because the flu virus mutates so quickly. So we'll see COVID continue to mutate. We'll have other variants. Mortality rate gets down to where the flu is, it becomes a non-issue.
Okay, while I have you too, I want to talk about the big economic forecast is coming up in March, and that's kind of your annual deal. Bill Connerly joins you. Maybe give us a preview.
Well, we're just going to, you know, Bill is an old friend. We've known each other, oh my goodness, almost 40 years. He's a contributor to Forbes, very, very solid business economist. I've always liked him because he is very practical and not afraid to say what he thinks. Unlike most economists, he'll be very specific in his predictions. And Bill has a very good understanding of how the economy affects businesses, how the backdrop influences what we do. And we'll answer a lot of questions around the economy, American business, and some of the things you asked today. Occasionally, he and I disagree and laugh a lot, but we're very interested in where this is going. I think Bill's a great source for everybody to listen to.
That's great. Well, we'll look forward to that, and we appreciate you joining us again, Patrick.
My pleasure, and you have a good one.
Thanks to WFG founder and executive chairman Patrick Stone for joining us. And thank you for partnering with WFG.